Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. This is Stephen Zimmer coming to you live out of Lexington, Kentucky for show episode number 244 as we explore the world of creatives. And we have another great featured creative guest for you tonight. Tonight, co-hosting with me is the one, the only, the amazing ASMR expert and author extraordinaire, R.G. Westerman. And joining us shortly will be Daniel Dark in progress, but he seems to be stuck at a cigar event at the moment, I think in Atlanta. So, yeah, he's living high life in these COVID times. But never worry, because RG and I are here for you, and, yeah, we're both going to hold down the fort. And she is on the line with me right now. Yes, safety protocol. So it's going to be cool, though, because tonight's guest, we have no idea about the direction tonight will take, because it's one of those multifaceted types, and we'll get into that shortly. But since last week, if I seem a little daft today, it's because I started the day real early, started working about 8 in the morning and kept going pretty much the entire day right until I took a small dinner break. And it was exactly when you, of course, messaged me. Yeah, you messaged me right when I took the break, so it made me look bad because I was slow in getting back to you. But I did get writing done.
So
five. That makes me sound better. Awesome.
See, my favorite thing. Someone said that. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say, like,
Clayton
when you message
Tommy
someone,
in the chat room.
It's the same. Oh, cool. Nice. But it's like leaving a calling card, and then they'll get back to you, like, when they're able to. So, like, I'm not one of those, like, well, it's been, like, 28 seconds. I wonder what – come on now. You know. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, if it's, like, a day and a half later, I'm like, oh, yeah, I messaged that person.
Yeah. Well, I admit, I get bad at times. Sometimes the inbox just gets crazy, and I'll slip behind by a few days, or something will get tacked down the inbox far enough that all of a sudden I'll be like a week later, I'll be like, oh, my God, you know, I didn't get back to somebody. And but I guess that's just part of the course here when you have to do the indie thing, and you don't exactly have a staff to help you.
You
have to kind of be the staff.
Well, but I do have a bit of exciting news.
Well, do tell.
It occurred to me, at least once a week, somebody will ask me a question about, like, strange things. Like, this week, it was my mom, and she was like, so what's, just out of the blue, we were talking about, like, groceries, and she says, so what's the deal with the lizard people? And
people.
I was like, okay. And so then, of course, immediately I responded with, well, actually, they're called reptilians. And then I went on, like, this brief history of, like, what that conspiracy is. And I won't go into it here because it'll take up the whole show. But so I decided I'm going to start a blog.
Fantastic.
And I've already gotten a couple of posts. I just haven't rolled them out yet, but I have a couple written. I'm going to try to do at least one a week, maybe one every 2 weeks or so. But yeah, and just like literally just answer all the questions that I get. Like I got at least 3 questions from people that I can work on from Imaginarium about zombies and apocalypse, you know, just all that stuff. Because yeah, for some reason people seem to think I'm the expert on like all things apocalypse. I don't know why, but yeah, so
well,
that's going to be rolling out on rgwesterman.com.
Well, that is that's a good position to be in if you're going to be seen as the expert on apocalypses and all, because in 2020 the likelihood of one is probably come closer. So you're probably going to be.
I told someone the other day. I said I was doing apocalypse before it was cool.
That's awesome. Oh, man. But, yeah, keep us posted on that. And, yeah, definitely share when you're on the air here, share the, you know, what you got going on in the blog, because that is cool stuff. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. I'm excited because I'm already doing the research. So I was like, you know, I might as well write this down.
Yeah. Yeah, Tommy B there. Yeah, they're bantering in the chat room already. And want to welcome, I think Madam Perry has joined us in the chat room as well, just looking in. Want to welcome, all of our listeners and guests participating. Always feel free to leave questions or comments for guests if you are in the chat room. And it is live and underway. So, and Tommy.
Yay.
Tommy B. That's great. He says, RG is faring so well during 2020. That makes her an expert on surviving the apocalypse. That's awesome.
Fingers crossed. We still have another, 23 days to go.
Oh, I know. And so much tumult. And yeah, it's amazing. But we've I do have some good news on our front. Today we actually launched a children's book imprint. That was fun.
I've always
wanted to kind of have that in our sphere. And it's called The Girl Who Grew a Sunflower Taller Than Herself. The illustrator is just 15 years old, and she's fantastic. Her name's Reagan Baxter, and the creator of the book and many other children's books that are in the pipeline. Of course, that's Dr. Vic. And that's the pen name for Dr. Vitesh Anakar, and he is a super cool guy, and it's a really good story. It's got a lot of stuff about nature, self empowerment, life lessons, and it's all about a young girl that decides one summer break to attempt to grow a sunflower, and so that's kind of what obviously the title comes from. But it's a really good and very positive type of messages in the book, and the illustrations fit it perfectly. And it's our first. It's called this imprint's called Seventh Star Child, so it fits with our thriller mystery group, Seventh Star Shadow. Of course, both under Seventh Star Press, and soon to be joined by Seventh Starlight, which is going to be our romance area. But that's a lot of fun.
Okay. Nice.
So
that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's cool, and it's nice to have such enthusiasm on a launch day, because sometimes as indies we get kind of frustrated. Launch days, you put out 8 million posts and you'll see a few responses, a few of your readers will, you know, chime in, and that's all that keeps you from despair on some of those days. But this one was wow. I mean, there was a lot of folks. Yeah. Some people were ordering like 4 copies. Some people ordered a couple. And I mean, the print side, and that's even factoring in that Amazon has been slow on getting the print listing up. It was so most of those orders were coming through Barnes and Noble, I think. Yeah. But it was neat
to
see like
by the holidays. I think
this enthusiastic response was encouraging. So yeah, I like that. We have to celebrate those kind of moments. But
absolutely.
We've got.
I know when my kids were that age, it was really hard to find like good quality. Like, you know, everything was either like this is a zebra, or it was like the Giving Tree, which everyone is kind of calling toxic now. So.
Right.
So it's
yeah,
good
there's
that
always
you're, like putting good things on the market like that. That's amazing.
It is cool, and I think you'd really enjoy this one. And as far as being very, very good and appropriate for kids, and we with the size of the book, the format, we went with a larger format. It's 8x10 pages, so it's a fairly larger book. Of course, it's full color all throughout, and it's kind of neat. Yeah, going through this for the first time, it's a lot of fun, and I'm excited about seeing where that goes. And. And this Friday, we have a cover reveal with Carol Preflatish's new book, The Coin Collector, and that we're really looking forward to that.
Very nice.
And that's her newest Nathan Perry mystery. So there's I am definitely busy this week. It's definitely crazy. and I'm editing a phenomenal. I love to share little anecdotes from my editing journeys, because I always encounter some amazing authors. I'm not going to give away too much about the book or the name, because it's not a publicly known book yet, but it's a fascinating story about, it's a nonfiction book that's kind of like a book on, kind of self-empowerment and how to succeed that kind of like mindset. And it's from a fellow that grew up in a refugee camp in Kenya. He's one of the Bantu people, and he lived in like unbelievable poverty and then came to America and has worked his way up. And it's about his path. And he has like this incredible passion for what America is. And he works in his life story and everything he went through in Kenya and his journey from there and his perspective as a Kenyan on our country and some comparisons. But it's a really positive vibe sort of project.
Yeah.
And it's really, I mean, his life journey is just, it's mind blowing and the kind of perspective that he has on poverty and struggle. I mean, wow. I mean, what do you hear some of the stuff that's in it?
I want to say that I've seen some marketing for him, like in the author groups and stuff. I mean, I don't know the name.
You probably have. You probably have.
Yeah. Okay.
But he's a really amazing character. Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. I've gotten to dig into his book and get to know him a little bit more. And of course, it's the first time I've worked with him.
Cool.
But I do look forward to being able to talk more specifically about it pretty soon.
Cool.
But yeah, this particular book is very interesting, really cool. And I guess we do have to recognize some sponsors. It's usually a good thing, right?
Sponsors, yes.
But we have one of the ones that you love to hear, that the Ren Garcia spot, which we always respond to. And then we have, of course, the wonderful Marianne Pohl. And then we will bring aboard our awesome guest of the week, who is right now, I believe, waiting on deck. So we're not going to delay too much longer. We're going to go ahead and bring up Ren's spot, and then we will get into Marianne Pohl's, a little information about Marianne Pohl. So here is from Ren Garcia.
The League of Elder dares to be unusual. It's easy to be swept away in this bold and uninhibited landscape where fantastic heroes become old friends and sinister villains inhabit every dark corner. Dare to explore things best left alone. Each book is your lantern, lighting the path to a world never before seen. So what do you say? Are you weird enough for us?
Do you want to answer that first, or me?
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are.
I always
I love
feel
that.
Like it's
I love
Bob
that.
The Builder, where it's like, are you weird enough? Yes, we are.
Yes, we. And we are. We are in a good way, a healthy way. non-creepy way. But yes, we are.
Of course, yeah. Naturally.
So, thank you. Thank you, Ren, and League of Elder, of course, great series, and got a great YouTube book online that's divided into segments so you can sample a very good audiobook version on YouTube on Ren Garcia's channel, so check that out. And Marianne Pohl, here is a little bit about her. In invisible battles being fought around us, if we listen closely, we can hear swords clashing in the war for human souls. The Iconoclast thriller series is not your typical horror. So, if you're looking for blood and guts, just for the sake of blood and guts, you won't enjoy these books. But if you're looking for frightful stories in which ordinary individuals must face extraordinary circumstances and the supernatural, look no further. And it starts with Raven's Cove, an Iconoclast thriller. And you can find those at Amazon and where all good books are sold. And, of course, visit her site at MariannePohl.com, MariannePohl, MariannePohl.com. And thank you, Marianne. You are awesome. So, I guess we'll go ahead and we will not make our guest Terry any longer. This is the first time this guest has been on the Star Chamber show, and the conversation is going to be interesting because our guest is one of those multifaceted Renaissance type talents, not only a screenwriter, but also an author, a comic creator, and a video game programmer. And I am pleased to bring aboard the Star Chamber show for the very first time the one, the only, Peter G. And Peter, you are, your mic is live.
Hey there, how's it going? What's popping, people?
Well,
hello.
Hello. Good to hear you. And looking forward to exploring your realms tonight for sure. And I know RG and I will have questions and we'll just take our conversation wherever it goes. But first of all, go ahead and feel free to introduce yourself so our audience can get a little idea of what you're all about, Peter.
Well, okay, so I'm Peter G, and it's kind of like on 12-ounce mouse. So what do? I do it all. I mean, I design and I program video games. I've created comic books. I've done comic strips. I've written books. I've done screenwriting. I'm currently an animator. I started animating a few years ago, and I've been running with that because it's actually been – the comic book industry is pretty much dead at this point, and this is actually getting some feedback, so I've been going with that. My Instagram, I've been rerunning my old comic strips for my comic series, Stress Puppy. And basically I get an idea, I find out what's the best way to explore that idea, and I make it happen somehow.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, that's kind of like the creative fire. Yeah. And
I love that.
I think that, yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you are one of these multifaceted type talents. And so I guess we could start in the comic area, because we have talked about that a little bit, the whole change in the industry with the digital transition and whatnot, and how it's affected it. And perhaps you hinted a little bit of that in your introduction there. But tell us a little bit about the comic side and the specific your specific comic strips that you're bringing back here. As far as the content in them.
Well, the comic thing, it's odd for me because I've spent a lot of years trying to be a comic book writer, and I couldn't get anywhere. I think I talked to an editor maybe twice in like 12 years or something like that. And this was despite, things like I did a comic book series called Soundwaves, which was an all-ages title. It was about a girl who was friends with a mermaid. The idea of it was that the reason mermaids don't drown is their singing lets them harmonize with the water. And this little girl, Rhapsody, sings just like them. And that enabled her to go on all these undersea adventures with her friend Melody. And the comics were intentionally short. I made them 16 pagers. I wanted to make them all-ages. The whole goal of the series was to make something parents could read with their kids and not want to blow their brains out. I'm sure you've seen how some things, this is an all-ages book, and either the parents can't take it or the kids can't take it. So I wanted to come up with something that spanned everything. And despite it, and, the 16 pages was actually an interesting little hurdle, because it meant the story had to be very compressed. You couldn't have, like, random tangents going off. You couldn't have plot lines that went nowhere. Everything had to be in that 16 pages, and you had to get the job done. And I showed this. There was an editor at Archie who actually thought it was interesting. I sent him some samples, never heard back from him. Basically, I got the feeling that the comic book industry was one big, I'll call you later, honey. And I just kind of I kind of ran out of gas, and especially with the changes that have been occurring lately, I didn't think the industry could get any worse than it was in the early 2000s, and yet somehow here we are. And I just I'm loving all the fan press. You got all these people who are making it. I'm not going to mention anyone because I don't want to make it seem like I'm calling anyone out. But like all the complaints about, comics are getting too woke, or, comics are too offensive and everything like that. It's the comic industry has been collapsing since the late 90s, when all the distributors like Capital Cities and them started going under, it created this very closed ecosystem where basically only certain ones were allowed to survive. And in doing so, because it choked off the indie readers for like the underground comics, like the Freak Brothers. I may not look it, but believe it or not, I'm punk. I know people look at me and go, "You're punk, really?" It's like, no, trust me, I am. And,
same.
But all these indie comics that brought in new readers because they didn't want to read just superhero stories, or they didn't want to read what everyone was telling them was revolutionary when it actually wasn't. People talk about something being like radical when all it is it's radical with a different coat of paint. I heard people talk about like Saga. Oh, it's such a great fantasy story. But if you strip it down to its bare elements, it's basically superheroes but with a fantasy overlay instead of a bunch of capes running around. So they sell this notion that it's something new and different when in reality it's the same thing. And then they get surprised when the readers take off and don't come back. The days of when you could come up with something like a Sam and Max freelance police. And I pin a lot of blame on Image for this because they rewrote what an indie comic was. before that you said indie comic, it's like, okay, so it's something, somebody's trying something different. What is it? With Image, indie comics became, you know, just superhero comics that weren't published by the big two. So the industry's been collapsing in on itself steadily. And admittedly, the current situation hasn't helped things much, but you see everyone complaining, well, they're, you know, they're going woke with, you know, Captain Marvel doing this or Squirrel Girl and stuff like that. That's what editors do. The whole job as an editor is to find something that will get the line selling. And if the audience is interested in that, that's what they're going to do. You know, I was one of the few people when Captain America said Hail Hydra at the start of that storyline, what was it, like 2-3 years ago? And, you know, Captain America was actually a Hydra sleeper agent. And everybody was complaining, it's ruining the legacy of the character. I'm like, no, no, no. DC Comics did this all the time. They would draw a cover with some weird situation and write themselves into a corner and tell the writers, come up with something that fits this. What they were doing was what writers do. You come up with something shocking that gets people talking, and you tell a story from it. And how soon people forget that. You know, it's I'm frankly kind of glad that I didn't get involved in the comic book industry, because it's gotten so inbred and so it's in a state where it will consume itself constantly if you are not on the right side of the right people. I've never believed in making friends with the right people, and that's what's cost me. But at the same time, I can sleep at night, and at least I'm still doing art that I'm proud of. I don't have people showing up on Facebook groups saying, hey, did you see this that he wrote 20 years ago? Isn't this embarrassing? It's like your parents bringing up the old pictures of you. Oh, no, that was – I was trying to be edgy or I, you know, hadn't practiced my art or anything like that. Please let that die, will you?
Well, I was going to ask you, though, on as far as how the comic industry is and how things are right now. I mean, obviously, this past year has been really shut down with live events, and of course, that is part of the lifeblood of indie creators, so that's been a little tough on us. But what I see, and this may be just totally anecdotal, but what I see coming through my various feeds on various platforms is a lot of indie comic creators have turned increasingly just and so they can afford to, you know, pay their, you know, illustrators and whatnot. They've turned increasingly to crowdfunding, you know, Kickstarter projects, Indiegogos, all that kind of thing, Patreon projects. And has that what's your take on that sort of orientation among the indie crowd and movement toward that sort of model, kind of like that prepaid crowdfunded bit?
Well, my basic philosophy, and I carry this over as far as my artistic endeavors, is I'm a fan of what works, and if going to Patreon or doing Kickstarters is what gets you the money to get your vision out there, then by all means do it. Comic book creators, especially the indies, have been consistently screwed over because every time there's a new advancement in the field, I mean, like, you see this all the time, like when Apple's iPhone came out, they came out with the App Store. And there were all these indie creators creating all these games. And then suddenly big publishers like EA looked and said, hey, we can make money here. And we can make even more if we make it ourselves. And then they started pushing big titles, which got more attention, which pushed them to the top of the recommendation charts. And all the indies started getting flooded out. You also see this with the Google Play Store. And you saw this when digital comics first took off. And everybody would say, yes, it's going to be the savior of indie pressers, which it wasn't. I've done the digital comic thing. It did not work out. I had one friend. It's like, yeah, give away like the first issue of your book for free and get people hooked on reading it. I did a comic series called Red Riding Hood, which was basically Tom and Jerry with Red Riding Hood and the Wolf. And the publisher put the first two issues online. Oh, it was a blast. It was basically my little salute to Tex Avery and Hanna-Barbera and all the great days of, you know, you just take two characters for whom the conflict is automatic and you just watch them beat the living daylights out of each other. And it was very funny. It was very funny. I mean, not to toot my own horn, but even looking back at some of those old issues and stuff like that, I still laugh and I'm like, wow, that would be great to see play out. But what people would do is they would download the two free issues and then they'd ignore the rest. You know, you have to accept that when it comes to things that are digital, there are people that only want the things that are free. They are not necessarily there for the story. They're just there to build a library, if you will. So if you're going to do that, you have to be smart about it, and you have to know what you're doing in order to try and get the in order to try and get money rolling in. And Patreon is basic. Patreon and Kickstarter are pretty much the only areas that the big publishers have not been able to crack. I think that's because there's something disingenuous about somebody like at Marvel, you know, who's backed by Disney money, suddenly holds a crowdfunding campaign and everything. Hey, wait a minute. Just open your checkbook.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's the same problem as before, because at least before, when you had like Capital Cities and stuff like that, if you wanted indie comics, you at least had an area you could go to and you could browse. You know, one of my biggest complaints about Apple's App Store is that you can't just browse. You know, anytime I want to look for something, I type in the first letter and I got to go through like 500. You can't type in things like, I want, you know, recommend me a game or something like that. I didn't even know the Worms series, which I love. Team 17 was just, you know, a bunch of geniuses. I didn't even know those were available in the App Store and I could put them on my computers until I literally came across them on accident. I was looking for a mini golf game and up popped Worms and I typed in. And there's a definite problem with getting the word out. And like I said, if you can make it work with Kickstarter or Patreon, more power to you, because it is just so easy to get lost in just the sea of noise out there. So it's great that it's moving. I would just love to see like some kind of a central area that points things out, instead of just like, you know, a few bloggers who make it their business, because it's very easy to miss those people if you don't know they exist,
right.
And then you're missing out on all these ideas and all these new worlds that are coming out.
Yeah, and you've hit the noggin on some things, because, I mean, authors have done it to ourselves on as far as pricing and so forth with the free giveaways with the 99-cent things. They've created like a climate of what I call ebook hoarders who just pile up all these ebooks at 99 cents or free, and they were actually even get around to reading them, frankly. And then it's, you know, and I can go on and on about what that's done in terms of the perception of independent ebooks. You know, we've talked about that in the show before, but the models, in the digital world, I mean, it's definitely been tough, but having a platform like Patreon where you have, you're not going to get throttled on algorithms. I mean, if you have a following on Patreon, they're going to get your notifications and your emails. And that's one good thing about it, is at least if you build a fan base, you can keep connected with them, I think, a little bit better than, of course, in the wonderful world of, you know, platforms like Facebook and all, where, you know, you put out a post and 2% of the people that like your page actually see it. And that's been a huge mess, you know, as far as the digital world goes. And I just want to let you know that Daniel Dark has joined us from Atlanta finally from his cigar event. So he is on. His mic is on. So.
Hello, welcome. But I just want to say, well, it's like that at conventions too, because, I mean, I would try and sell my comic books at conventions, and I would always get the leper walk where people often don't make eye contact, just keep going. And I was a big believer in low-pressure sales. You know, I basically just put something out, and if it caught someone's eye, they came over to look, then I would engage. But you have people that will try and hawk it, or they'll stand outside, and everybody will get upset. But it's like, but you got to do something to get interest, because people are just going to ignore you. So it's like, yeah, just trying to get that attention. It's been a problem all along. It's not just anything new to digital. It's been that way since the beginning. You know, do you got anything with superheroes? And like, okay, from what I told you about Soundwaves, going to comic conventions was one of the hardest things, just because people who go there were generally looking for superhero comics. They were not looking for an all-ages series about a girl who's friends with a mermaid. So that was a very tough sell to begin with right there. So and also keep in mind, I'm in the Chicago area. We don't have a lot of comic shows here. The ones we have mostly focused on capes. My understanding, I don't know this for sure because I haven't been out there to check this out, but my understanding is that, like, on the East Coast, there's comic conventions, like, every weekend or every other weekend. And people who print their own books can usually at least make enough to, you know, justify the effort out there. But there's also the question of the environment you're in and what people expect from comic books. You know, here in the Midwest, there's just not the same interest as there would be anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, RG and Daniel?
Well, I mean, when I've been at the conventions, it's like you were talking about, like getting out and kind of barking. You know, you have to be your own like biggest fan in a way, like just in the climate, because there are so many indies, and it's, you know, putting out content and creating quality content is what's going to get attention, you know, even just from the readers. But you have to get eyeballs on your content, and that's the challenge a lot of times.
Absolutely.
Now, Daniel? One of the things that a friend of ours actually did, a friend of mine and Stevens, that he went out before the convention opened with books and sold books to the people standing in line.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yep.
That was nice.
That would be Tony Acree. I know exactly who you're talking about, of Hydra Publications. Yeah, but yeah, Tony is fearless. Yeah, he is amazing when it comes to selling. But yeah, I think that's true. But yeah, the Midwest. I mean, even at conventions. I mean, we know that because, you know, we work with the Imaginarium Convention. But it's conventions are now pretty saturated too, even in the Midwest. I mean, there is, given every weekend, I mean, there are events going on that are, you know, in some way relating to it. Maybe they're not straight up Comic-Cons, but something involving, you know, the speculative media, speculative fiction kind of world. I mean, are happening in the region on pretty much a weekly basis. I know, again, you know, we're saying a little bit more pre-COVID, you know, now that, you know, it's gone through this past year, but I do think there's, yeah, definitely a lot of opportunity even through the Midwest for the comic side of things too. And we've seen an uptick of that even at our own convention. But
and learning how to take advantage of the digital market is also a huge segue. Like, a lot, because, you know, all of us Gen X people who are my age and older, you know, we remember the physical magazines that we used to, you know, print out in the back alley of the bathroom clubhouse or whatever, you know.
Yep.
But now with everything being digital, in some ways that's an advantage. You know, there's pros and cons to that, you know. But being able to make that shift is definitely a challenge.
Well, I'm going to throw this at Peter. You've definitely touched on something, RG, and that's with the physical medium, it's the collectability factor. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you can't really collect a digital something for resale. I mean, a file. With a physical copy, I mean, you have a tangible something that, you know, could potentially have resale value in the future, a collectible market, memorabilia, that kind of thing. And it's I wonder, you know, what the effect is, you know, when comics go fully digital and lose that collectability factor. I wonder what the effect is on the comic world as a whole. And that's something maybe Peter would like to comment on.
I'm not really, I mean, that is definitely a factor, the idea of being able to like resell it or something like that. You're talking to somebody that enjoys collecting like animation art and storyboards and that, and with the move to digital, they're impossible to find nowadays. But it's also an oversimplification of the idea that what you're getting is an investment in case you want to dump it in the future. Because, like me, I have over 1,000 movies on DVD. And the reason I have it is those are not just movies that I watch. Those are trophies. People come over and I take them into the video vault and say, look at this. So for some people, yes, the idea that you can sell it as memorabilia, but for some of us, it's the idea of having a physical representation that we can flex with. So there is that consider too.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think there's definitely a desire for tangible mediums, and I say this as a vinyl enthusiast. I watched vinyl pretty much die in the 90s. I mean, as far as new vinyl, I mean, there was obviously record events and things with, you know, used vinyl and, you know, sealed copies and whatnot, but new vinyl kind of went away for a while. But then all of a sudden, you know, in the later 2000s, it started percolating back, and it's roared back to the point that they actually sell more vinyl than CDs in the music industry now. It surpassed it. Mm-hmm. And every new release from a band is out in vinyl now. And it's, I love it, for frankly. But the funny thing is, you know who is driving it, I think, in a large part? It's the young folks, Generation Zs and younger millennials.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead on that.
Don't discount the young people, because, like, my son, mm-hmm. for example, he's about to turn 12, and he only wants physical comics. Like, he's obsessed with comics, but he doesn't even digital is not even on his radar. I mean, he's a digital kid. He has, you know, does YouTube, he does games, et cetera, but when it comes to comics, it has to be ink on paper. That's the only way he'll consume it. And, you know, I mean, he's just one kid, you know, multiply that by however, you know, and he's just 12. He's going to grow up and be reading comics maybe for the rest of his life, you know? So, yeah, I think the younger people will bring it back.
We've got
being
interesting
a Gen A person myself, you know, I still read, you know, like a good comic or a good graphic novel.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we got
questions for you about your batteries. Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, you don't have to worry about the batteries crashing out on you, and you can't read it until it charges up again.
Right, exactly.
No, that's true. We got a question for Peter from the chat room. This is from Clayton, and it's an interesting one. Question for Peter as an author, illustrator, coder. Why do you think that, okay, I hope I pronounce this right, I'll spell it, Oelvin, original English language visual novels, never caught on in the U.S.? And he says, full disclosure, I've written and coded three of them. But he's wanted to ask you about that.
I don't know that they haven't, because you see some, I mean, like, I go to, like, anime conventions and then I see visual novels everywhere, but those are being sold to a specific audience. I think part of the problem with visual novels is that they're either quirky, like the Pigeon Simulator that they have on Steam, or they're self-referential, what was it, Doki Doki Literature Club or something like that, where the whole thing is basically a massive joke. In order for art to succeed, you need people who want to push the boundaries and do other things. You know, Lord of the Rings. Yeah, lots of people read Lord of the Rings, but bottom line, it was Peter Jackson's movie that made it accessible to a mass audience, that made mm-hmm. people understand why this thing was so amazing. And I think for visual novels to catch on, they need somebody that can actually do that. That will actually crossover. The seeds are there. The possibility is definitely there. I mean, if you look at things like GTA, especially like the single-player campaigns of GTA, where you're following one person who you got dealt a bad hand, so you have drama, you have comedy, you have ambition, you have all the elements that make a compelling story right there. You just need to figure out what it is that will make it jump over to other people, and that assumes that it's worth the effort. I mean, remember, GTA 5 has made more money than anything Hollywood has put out ever. So it's not so much a question of how do they make the jump. I think that they just don't feel they need to make the jump. So you're not going to have people like that trying to come up with new ways of getting the artwork or getting the stories out. It's going to fall to the indies who somehow figure something out. Like I said, the possibility is there. We've seen people react to it. I mean, once again, GTA has brought in so many people who have followed the stories. It can be done. It's just, as far as how to do it, I don't know. But as far as why it hasn't caught on yet, I don't know, because everything is there. It could just be that people are afraid of the time commitment. I know that I tend to balk at some games because I hear, you can't just sit down and play Link to the Past. Link to the Past was probably my favorite Zelda game, just because it kept focus on the story and you kept going. Now you got the stories that take 100 hours to complete and all these side quests, and people just you got a job, you got a family, you got to sleep, you got to eat. Where do you find the time to do all this? So I don't know why it hasn't caught on yet. It's definitely a question bigger than my experience can answer. I look forward to seeing someone doing it, though. I hope someone does it, because once again, the possibilities are just amazing. And we've seen with things like alternate endings for movies and everything, people are accepting of that. It's just a matter of putting the right thing together, like what Telltale did before they consumed themselves. The possibility is there. It's just a matter of getting over that hump and getting into that new realm.
Very cool. Very cool. And, you had brought up one thing. I do want to segue just a little bit because I want to make sure that we do cover some of your other areas. But you're mentioning that it's kind of disingenuous when major companies do online, like, crowdfunding. And it just made me think, it finally hit me, that I just saw one recently that was dealt with Atari actually doing an Indiegogo campaign for their VCS 800 console. I don't know if any of you all have seen that, but they're actually trying to bring out a new console. And it's quite a mess around it. From what I understand,
I wrote an article about it for I wrote two articles about it on Bleeding Cool, and the first one I was besieged by astroturfers from the Atari campaign trying to basically say anybody that has suspicions about this, you're just haters or whatever, even though they had already run two campaigns that were sketchy to begin with. Yeah, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Atari nut. That was my first game console. And even I'm going, no, give me something more to go. You know, it's going to come preloaded with a bunch of Atari games. Yeah, you can get that on Steam for $20, and you can run that on any hardware you have. You don't need to So when I wrote the second article, updating everything, including how the demo video was faked, in the very second paragraph, I said, and by the way, to all the people out there who are Atari fanboys who tried to silence me last time, I know you're reading this, so hi, gang, and I'm at the article.
Yeah, I had seen some of that about that, and I was like, first when I saw the whole campaign and everything, I was like, oh wow, because like you, yeah, that comes from even my day, and we've had like Howard Shore has been a guest on a. Howard Scott Warshaw has been a guest. Howard Shore, I'm thinking of the Lord of the Rings composer there. But Howard Scott Warshaw has been a guest on the show. And, of course, you remember him probably from Yar's Revenge and, of course, the famous E.T. Video game debacle that had a documentary around it. Yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark and all kinds of great stuff. It kind of caught my attention when I saw Atari was trying to make a little bit of a move. Then I saw the Indiegogo campaign and raised like $3 million from like 12,000, pledgers. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, it sounds like you're into this. And then I saw articles like yours and I was like, oh man, I was kind of dampened it a bit when I saw that there's a big mess around it.
When the Indiegogo goes radio silent for 8 months and then the only thing they post is update coming soon, it's like, yeah, you got a problem here.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely. But my point for bringing that actually up is a roundabout way of, when I was finding out about you that you also were a video game programmer. Yeah, we don't get often chance to talk to a programmer. I mean, like I said, the last one was Howard Scott Warshaw on the show here. So I'd love to learn a little bit about your background in coding, video game programming, and stuff you've been involved with on that side of the coin.
Well, it's nothing like professional. It's not like I work for like EA or anything like that. It's all just indie stuff that I self-published. I got my start with a simple rad kit, and I made a Pearls Before Swine, the comic strip by Stephen Passis. I made a fan game of that, and I just did a few other things. I work a little bit on programming the old Atari 2600. I've been thinking of getting back into programming. It's just I've been so overwhelmed with all the other stuff I've been working on. It's like, something has to give. So it's like, yeah, let's finish working on the movie here, and then we'll get into programming the games. Because part of the problem is that the languages on a surface level are almost identical. They all have the same things like, your conditional loops. I don't remember the last time I saw anything that even played with line numbers. It's all brackets and functions and subroutines now. But even then, how the compiler interacts with all the stuff you need to actually make the game come alive. I mean, like, I learned C++, and you literally cannot do anything on that without additional libraries. And so even if you want to make a simple text game, you need N curses or PD curses or something in order just to do a text game. So even just sitting down to program something simple, that's the reason why Python has taken off, because you've got everything you need right there in order to at least get started. You're not frustrated and go, okay, so what can I use and what are the rights management uses? What are my limitations? It's just take it, go, and you can build on the rest later. Because I experimented with Pascal. Pascal has the same problems as C++. I've heard a lot of people talk about C Sharp. And, OC with classes and everything. I'm seeing a lot of languages like Swift and, to a lesser degree, Google's Go language. And I say to a lesser degree because I don't like Google and how they run their software projects. I'm still furious with Google they built everything on Android on open source, and yet once they got big enough, the first thing they did, they dropped open document format in favor of their own proprietary Google Docs. Thanks a bunch. But there has been a tend to try and move things to simplify them, but you still have to figure out. But once again, the upper level for the logic branches is all the same. It's all a matter of how you implement the graphics. And as we've gotten into this ecosystem where, Android has its own way of interacting with the interface, Apple has their own way, you can't really go with one language and just use libraries to fill in the gaps unless you really know what you're doing. So in some ways, the programming field has gotten easier, but in other ways, it's gotten a lot worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, it's just – I got a few friends that are trying to independently develop video games right now, and it's just amazing to watch the odyssey they're undergoing in creating them, from the coding standpoint, and then also and even in deciding, I guess, the game engines to use, because I've watched a few Switch game engines, midstream even, on what engines they want to develop their games around, and that sounds like a bit of a mess in itself.
Yeah, I mean, especially with everything going on with the Unity engine and Epic suddenly deciding it's going to get nasty and try and, we're trying to affect a positive change in the Steam store and in Apple stores and stuff like that. I'm like, no, you're not. Quit being disingenuous. You're doing it because you've got the money to throw your weight around, and that's why you're doing it. And it's Unity is very popular. I understand why, but anything that gets popular, I tend to get really leery of, because all it takes is one mistake, and this thing you rely so heavily on is gone. My animation setup, I do my animations on all three major platforms. I do it on Linux, I do it on Mac, I do it on Windows. Windows is a lesser extent, but that's because the tools I use, like Anime Studio, are either cross-platform or can be cross-platform if you know what you're doing with Linux. Or I have open source programs that work on all of them, like Audacity I use for my audio programming. There's versions of that for all platforms and everything. Basically, when Apple pulls these things like, we're going to go to ARM processors guess what? All of that tens of thousands of equipment that you just bought, it's useless now and you got to rebuy it. Good luck. Me, I'm like, you take away the Mac platform? Well, I still got two others I can use, so get bent. One of the reasons that's why I worry so much about the over-reliance on things like Unity. A monoculture is a very dangerous thing. And Unity, like I said, it has the advantage of it's well-supported. Everybody knows it and everything like that. But all it takes is one thing like Epic trying to start a hissing match with all these other platform holders. Well, we just won't host Unity games anymore. And everything that you've been working for, especially if that's your living, comes crashing down around you. So it's definitely something you got to keep in mind is you need flexibility, but the flexibility is so difficult. So, people that, focus on Unity, to quote Chris Rock, I'm not saying they should do it, but I understand.
I myself haven't developed a game before, but I do see that there's a lot of components and levels, just like in a way, kind of like putting together a film project. I have done that several times. So it's definitely a very multifaceted project to put together, and for definitely for an indie developer or a solo person, like I've mentioned some of the people I know. I mean, that's a lot of hats to wear, and you're right. Yeah, when you come at platform dependency, it gets kind of scary.
Well, it also depends on the project you're trying to work on, because I firmly believe part of the reason for the rise of retro gaming with things like Stardew Valley and Shovel Knight is because you don't have to spend as much time getting the artwork absolutely right, like if you were trying to do a Gears of War. You can use mm-hmm. the minimalism and the simplicity to your advantage. And so, I mean, I've seen people that can, like, people who, like, you know, they subsist on ramen for a few months and they manage to get a game out. But that's also a question of the scale of the game. If you go into it thinking that you're going to create the next Doom or the next Quake, you're going to need a ton of support. But if you start small with something that's manageable, like most of my games that I created just like one of the games I created, I was intentionally for something that I could play while I was on hold on the phone. So it was
nice.
You know, very focused. It was a single board. And, you know, it had a little bit of interest. I gave it away for free. If I charged for it, there would probably be – people would have been like, you want money for this? Are you kidding me? You got to keep that in mind. but you absolutely can do it yourself, but you have to be aware of the scale of what you're trying to do. You don't want it to turn into – what was it? What was it called? Bob's Game or something like that? It was some kind of project he was trying to submit to Nintendo. But it was so big and so sprawling, there was no way he could have done it himself. I really can't remember the game's name. But yes, once things start spreading out, like for me with my animations, my minimalist cartoony style works. But if I was trying to do something that was much more serious with much more gravitas, I would need to bring in a staff and other people to do it. And yeah, that's when the project starts getting complicated, because you got to manage people, you got to manage egos, because everybody thinks that thinks that they're going to be the next big thing. Around the early 2000s, I was trying to launch a comic book series, and I was looking for an artist that was willing to work cheap, and there was only one guy who basically could fit the bill. And I said, okay, you want the gig? He said, well, before we do, I'd like to negotiate the terms of the contract. I'm like, this didn't come up before. What do you got in mind? And one of the things he said was he wanted a royalty on all books drawn in his style. And I heard drawn in his style. I'm like, yeah, lawyers get rich arguing what a phrase like that means.
Yep. And, oh, God, yeah.
And I just read the sentence over. I'm like, it's my book, my writing, my time, and most importantly, my money. You aren't investing a dime of it. By me offering to pay you a $5 page rate, you're going to see more money off of the first year of books than I'll see, period.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are wanting a 50% royalty on anything. And how am I supposed to track that and prove it's above board so you don't come into court later? So naturally,
exactly.
I had to get that, and the project died. So,
wow!
Right response,
yeah,
though I understand.
I had worked on one comic that was supposed to be. I had always wanted to be one of those people that would help get other people get their big break and stuff like that. And I had worked on a Doctor Who fan comic because I was a fan of My Little Pony. The first three seasons, I want to emphasize, I'm a fan of the show. I'm not a brony. The bronies it's like, I watch the show cause it makes me laugh. I am not, when people start going on about the lore of the series, that's when I start checking out. And there were these people who wanted to, it's like, well, you know, he writes for Bleeding Cool and these things around, you know, here's a chance for us to get our names out. And coordinating it, one of the people said that she would coordinate everything, and she didn't, and she started passing it off on me. I didn't have the background to know what was going on, so I couldn't run it efficiently, and the whole thing, basically, it got done. You know, we got that done, but then everybody started saying, well, P, you should have done this, you should have done that. And that was when I decided, you know what, if I'm going to do something, unless it's somebody I really know, I'm doing it all myself, and I am running the show. And if I bring somebody in, you know, it was a harsh lesson in what you need to do as project lead, producer, whatever you want to call it. But it's something that you have to do, and you have to know what your limitations are and your style.
because my philosophy was I was not going to bring in talented people and tell them what to do. Well, guess what? That was exactly what I needed to do. So.
Right.
So it can be done, but you got to know your limitations, and you got to know what you're – if you do not have clarity of what your end goal is, and if you do not make sure everybody's on the same page as you, it's going to spiral out of control. So you got to keep an eye on the ball the entire time.
That's fantastic advice. Yeah, I hope folks listen and keep that to heart, because I have seen it again and again in all kinds of different mediums, and film especially. If you got everybody on the same page, success. And if you got people that are cancerous that are brought in and ego driven, like you were describing earlier, that become problematic quickly, the whole thing falls apart very quickly. And that's definitely good advice. So I do want to pass on. Clayton had a good comment in the chat room. I didn't want to interrupt you, but when we were talking about reliance on one platform situations, he says monoculture. We engineers call that a point source failure and move heaven and earth to avoid them. So I'll just throw that little comment in from Clayton.
Yeah, the developers try to avoid it, but the marketers sure don't.
No.
Here's
a
suite of office programs that integrate seamlessly. No!
No.
Back to hell with you. Get away from me.
That's too much.
As somebody that's never done any of the coding or anything like that, to give an example of why you should be paid, how many hours of coding, like for the simplest game that you've ever done, how many hours of coding did you have to do for that game?
I wouldn't go with my simplest one. I would go with the one that has had the most success. I did a game called Cloudburst, which was – it was a simple four-leveler. It was quick, but it was also very challenging. I wanted something that could ramp up the difficulty quick, and it was basically like a bowl of Pringles. It's like you eat one, you go for another, and you go for another, you go for another. And that one took me about – not counting because I still had to work my job and everything like that, and I was covering conventions for Bleeding Cool. That one took me about a month and a half, and that included things like trying to debug it because the game engine had this wonky way of working. It basically was engineered to make single board games, and I was trying to make something a little more complex than it was ready for. So there was also experimenting with the code. And as far as what I would have charged for it, I don't know, because there's so many different variables that go into it, like what studio are you working with? What kind of perks are you getting? Tommy Talrico, I'm connected with him on LinkedIn. He's a great guy. And if Tommy Talrico, he's launching the new the revival of the Intellivision next year. And if he said, it's like, hey, would you like to design a game for the Intellivision? Because a lot of the games are basically just revivals of their old single boarders. I would gladly do that for free, just so I can say, hey, I'm a part of this. But if there's a bigger studio and they suddenly say, we want you to, make a Mortal Kombat single-player adventure game, we want you to make, Sub-Zero Anthologies, but make it so it doesn't suck. That's going to take a lot of time, a lot of effort, and it's like, okay, get your checkbook open, let's talk. I got what they were trying to do with Anthologies. I got what they were trying to do with the game engine. They shouldn't have tried it. It just was the fighting game engine was not meant for a side-scrolling adventure.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, RG, now you have a bigger perspective when you set out to do your first Ash-based video game.
Yes.
Yeah,
I'll
definitely.
Have to keep this in my Rolodex.
Let's see. I got a comment on time, by the way, Daniel from Clayton. He said his 24 hour to play VN took 3 months to write and 4 months to code, but had to teach himself Renpy, R-E-N-P-Y, from scratch. Good coder could have done it in 2 weeks, he thinks. So just want to pass that comment on. That's relevant to what we're talking about there. But
I try not to get caught, because there's always somebody that can do it faster. It took you 2 months to create Flappy Bird on the Atari 2600. I could have done that in 2 hours and a cup of coffee. It's
this isn't a contest, dude. It's to be expected. Anytime you have people who know what they're doing, you're going to have an element of competition. But there comes a point where it's like, dude, come on, some people are just doing the best they can, and some people, their minds just don't work that efficiently when it comes to programming. Give them a break. At least they're getting the job done.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what I always focus on is, are they actually doing something? That's the key. And, like I said, my people that I've mentioned, they're developing games right now. I mean, they have various strengths and, certain areas they're, much quicker in, certain they're not. But they're marching forward nonetheless, and that's the key, and that's how you get somewhere. But I want to shift now a little bit to the writing side of things, because of course, Daniel, RG, and myself are that. As far as screenwriting and writing, I want to delve into your storytelling side and the type of stories and characters that draw you and the kind of stories that you like to write. I want to hear about the Peter G. world on writing.
It's kind of tough to explain. My creation process is very different from other people. My brain does not work like a normal human brain. It does not come up with things and go in a logical succession. I have a tendency to think in complete concepts. Like, I will go along, I will think of something, and all of a sudden it just starts popping to life in my mind. The concept like for Sound Waves. Sound Waves was originally just going to be a throwaway. I just wanted to do it as like a 2-3 issue miniseries of this girl who becomes friends with a mermaid, and then at the end of it they say their goodbyes and go on with their lives. But as I started writing it, and the relationship between the girls started catching on, and because one of the things I wanted to capture was that they were genuine best friends. I didn't want it to be just, this foreign exploration of another world. And as they interacted and their personalities fit or clashed at times, I'm a very big believer in you don't always show friends getting along in your stories, because they're still two distinct people. They're going to have disagreements once in a while. And as they work together and addressed each other's differences, the whole thing started taking on a whole new dimension, and it blossomed into 12 issues, a special Christmas special, and there's still more stories I just haven't gotten around to finishing yet. It could easily go longer, and all because that one little seed of these two are friends just poof went off and it became what it did. The idea of one series I do, and you can find these on Amazon. I might as well promote this because, the books are really creeping along. I do a series called Hannah Singer, Celestial Advocate. You will read this and you will go, Pete is a devout Christian who doesn't get along with fundamentalist Christians very well. Got it. I've been at comic shows where I've had the books out, and there was one guy who was a fundie who was absolutely offended by what I wrote in the books. Like, at one point, Hannah at one point explicitly states that being gay is not a sin, and this just sent him through the roof. And the gist of the story is that basically Hannah is your defense attorney in heaven. You die and you get up there. You don't get to heaven right away. You have to stand trial and answer for your crimes of life. And there are two sides. There's the church side, which interprets according to your church doctrine. And then there's the celestial side, which argues God's mercy. And Hannah is one of the best celestial advocates for the celestials. And her whole point is, it's not the what of your actions, it's the why. Life is imperfect. People have to make difficult choices. They should not be penalized for being backed into a corner and just doing the best that they can. And in the first book, the very first story, she's defending a porn star. And over the course of the series, she does. The first book, she defends a porn star. She actually argues for a mermaid to become an actual human soul instead of just vanishing into nothing. She has to actually argue against Thomas de Torquemada from the Inquisition and keep him out of heaven because his actions violated God's will, which is mercy. The stories are really are
because I built her up, the whole point of the story, she won her first trial. She represented herself. She had to. She was an atheist. And
nice.
if you're wondering how an atheist gets into heaven, read that story. You'll find out. And but because I built her up, I want to create her character. Oh, it's well. The problem with the stories is that I built Hannah when I was creating her character. I wanted her to basically be the female equivalent of James T. Kirk in a way. When I saw Star Trek Generations at the theater, you know, the scene towards the end when they're getting ready to take on Malcolm McDowell and stop the ribbon, and Picard's up there and the audience is watching, and then Kirk showed up and the audience went nuts. It's, yeah, you're going to get it now.
Nice.
And that was what I wanted with Hannah. But that means that I have to come up with the toughest cases for her to argue and try and win. And I have to keep them honest, too. Hannah doesn't win every case. There are times when she does lose, because otherwise she's just a Mary Sue. So it's more like a mystery.
Right.
It's not a question of does she win. It's how is she going to do it. And that. But the whole gist of it was I created this character that I thought was very compelling. She's smart. She's funny. And she's a spitfire. She doesn't take grief from anyone. She's arguing with one of the church officials out of the court grounds one time, and he's trying to talk about how he opposed God. I'm just like the Israelites. And Hannah shoots at him, if the Israelites were like you, God would have written the Ten Commandments in crayon. And, oh, yeah. I made her to be bold and unafraid, but that also means that there's a lot of pressure to make the stories the absolute best I can make them. And but it all comes together because I have a compelling character at the center of it all. And it's mostly the characters that get me interested in writing. I've tried writing like generic stuff, and it's always fallen apart on me because I just don't have the interest. You give me a character that has like a unique point of view or just a unique way of dealing with things, and the story starts building itself because how the character reacts. My idea of a good story is if you take the character out and replace them with another one, the story goes in a completely different direction because everything happens as a result of what that character thinks, believes, and what actions they would take. And there's just – and if I can take the character out, put another one in, and it ends the same, I've done something wrong. So for me, it always starts with an interesting character to hang the story on, and it goes from there.
Very cool. And I do want to bring up something from Clayton here in a minute because it's a good question, actually. I'm interested to hear your answer. But I'll give a couple of the titles. I looked them up on Amazon. I put a link to this one on A Wing and a Prayer. I put a link to that in the chat room if you're watching in there. And then also I found Hope Springs Eternal. These are from the case files of Hannah Singer. And, those are on Amazon and paperback, as I can tell here.
The first book is just Hannah Singer, Celestial Advocate. There's three books in the series. So the first is Hannah Singer, Celestial Advocate. The second is On a Wing and a Prayer. And the third one is Hope Springs Eternal.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, because this looks like it's right up my alley. I love this kind of stuff. And so you get to know where Clayton's coming from. He says, I'm an Orthodox Catholic who offends prods and heretics daily in books and in person. I love writers who offend people. Yes, Clayton, I have figured that out about you. Yes, I have. Questions
you
for Peter.
I was going to say, you would be enjoying I've been rerunning my old Stress Puppy comic strip on my Instagram, and I'm in the middle of the Loose Cannons storyline. In Loose Cannons, Justin Cale, who's in charge of HR, Rafferty Daniels, or Raff as they call him, is a middle manager, and his whole job is just to try and keep the different departments from throttling each other. Justin's in charge of HR, and he comes up to her, Raff, I made this calendar, and I want you to look it over. In an effort to be inclusive, I put in every winter holiday I could think of. I put in Diwali, I put in Kwanzaa, I put in Boxing Day, I put in Festivus, I put in, can you think of any that I missed? And Raff goes, Christmas. And which actually happened. There was a company that tried to be inclusive, and they forgot to put Christmas on the holiday calendar. And it was a genuine people who took it as part of the war on Christmas, and they were genuinely offended. And Loose Cannons runs with that, where there's a guy in the office who feels that there's a war on Christmas going on, and Raff is trying to keep this from spiraling out of control. And yeah, it's a mix of commentary, humor, and especially because in a couple of strips, Holly Faraday, who's the CTO, and she was raised in a Catholic school, but she's a bad Catholic. She gets mixed up in this, and it gets great. It's probably probably the most popular storyline. Yeah, it's on my Instagram. If you go on Instagram, look for Sign Timore, S-I-N-E space T-I-M-O-R-E, Sign Timore Animation Studios, and you'll see me, and I put hashtags so you can go back. I've been running the strips there for a few months now, and you can see the insanity that I put Raph through, poor guy.
Right.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm definitely looking these up. They sound like I'd love to read these and see these.
Yeah.
He does have a serious question for you, Peter. He says, this is an interesting one. Have you read Niven and Purnell's Inferno and Escape from Hell? It is Origen's argument about hell. He wanted to ask you that.
No, I have not. It's my religious beliefs are very independent. I didn't really have access to a lot of different books on religion when I was growing up. Like, the bookstore stocked a lot of stuff for, like, New Age stuff, which some of it made a little bit of sense, some of it didn't. And I was actually an atheist for a little while myself. I stumbled around because the problem was that, for me, the church was not really explaining things. There was a brilliant TV show called Nothing Sacred. This was back in the 90s. It was kind of like Midnight Caller, but for religion, where it didn't present a right or wrong answer. It just presented a situation and examined it, and how something so simple can be so fraught with spiritual peril. And there were people who were offended by this because they felt it's Christianity. Once you accept Christ, everything is fine. It's like, no, it's not like
right.
that. Which is, as you can tell, the whole emphasis behind the Hannah Singer stories. So for a long time, I wasn't really getting answers. And then I got lucky at a church service, because I was still going back and forth. I met my teacher. She's basically wandered around the world and just meeting people and trying to help them out. And we started talking, and she started teaching me about the nuts and bolts of the religion, especially about how anybody that acts like being Christian makes you superior to anyone else, she absolutely hates. It's like, that's not what this is about. Holly in the Loose Cannon storyline, when she appears, she specifically points out it's like her faith is about personal faith, not about public validation. But you got a lot of people that do that. So by the time I started actually learning and exploring these ideas, I had an actual person who knew the history so well, it was like she lived it. And she knew nonsense when she heard it. And so I hadn't really read any of the books or anything like that, because I just hadn't gotten around to it. They weren't generally available. And I had what I felt was an excellent teacher. I'm trying to think. This was a long time ago. I admit with a lot of shame that I used to be one of the people who didn't think that gays had a right. I thought being gay was a mental disorder or something like that. And I constantly heard, being gay is a sin. And one day I asked her, she told me, ask her anything. And even if she doesn't know the answer, still ask it. You need to learn. You need to explore. And I asked her flat out, I said, is being gay a sin? And she looked at me like I sprouted a second head and said, no. She actually laughed and explained why it wasn't. And it's like, okay, so when it comes to learning about things, she was the way to go. And that's why a lot of these people say, well, I studied the Bible. I'm like, if you study the Bible, you would know that that's not right, because it's right there. Mm-hmm. You don't do this stuff. Here's a fun little fact for you. The whole thing in the Bible about, to lay down with a man as you would a woman is an abomination. That's a mistranslation from around the 6th century. It's actually to lay down with a boy as you would with a woman.
Yep.
So it actually condemns pedophilia. It's not condemning homosexuality. And so, but yet, that how Mary Magdalene became Mary the prostitute that Jesus talked with. There's all these convenient mistranslations or people just not bothering to look things further because, hey, this is the answer that serves their agenda. It's confirmation bias. And the true message has gotten lost over time. So I'm not saying that it's good to ignore the books or anything like that. I'm just saying the direction I went in, it sounds like it brought me to the same place, but But it tried a different path. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like I talked with people, one guy who was a Christian who was Native American, and he said, well, Native American religion made more sense to me. I said, then do it. The whole point of this is to understand yourself mm-hmm. and to understand humanity. If that's what, you know, again, I'm a fan of what works. And when you read the Hannah Singer books, you'll see that I don't believe that God's going to let a little thing like following a different religion or not believing in him stop you from getting into heaven. It's, did you lead a good life? Did you help people? Yes. That's how you do it, not by converting people and slamming their butt in a pew.
All right.
Yeah,
so,
I'm a very different breed of Christian, aren't I?
Oh no! We trust me. This show,
no.
This show, we have diversity of thought. We have had all expressions and all types on this show. So do not worry a bit. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny you use the word funny, and I haven't heard that word since I was a child, basically. So, which I kind of grew up in that same background, so I'm listening and hearing you, and I'm sitting here nodding my head and everything. So.
Yeah, well, it's also the reason why when it comes to my religious beliefs, I try not to be pushy because, like I said, for a lot of years up until my teacher straightened me out, I had a lot of very questionable views that I am not proud of, and as a result, it's like, you know, it's like I can't go around and say, well, I'm better than everyone, because it's like, no, I used to be just as bad. If you guys had met me like 30 years ago, you wouldn't have liked me very much. So I'm not going to go around and like I'm better just because I've actually figured things out. If anything, that makes it my responsibility to try and help other people on their journey and keep the and, you know, enable them to be left alone as they figure things out and not have people, you know, beating their heads in. You know, my biggest complaint nowadays is prosperity gospel. That just drives me.
Get me started.
I understand why people subscribe to it, because they want some reassurance that all these good deeds they're going are not going to waste. But it's also God does not make deals. You know, the devil God doesn't make deals. So thinking that you can do this and buy your way into heaven, especially because it creates a disconnect between you know, doing good things for God and doing good things for your fellow man. Well, they're supposed to be intertwined, but they create the separation. So you can just abuse people and treat them like dirt, but as long as you go to church every Sunday and throw some money in the poor box, hey, you're in. It's like, no, it doesn't work like that. And it never should, because you're basically saying you can be bought. You're not saying you're doing things from the goodness of your heart. That was the reason why I hated the TV show Highway to Heaven so much with Michael Landon. Because he was an angel on probation trying to earn his wings back. It's like, well, that's not he's doing it because he's an angel. He's doing it to barter his way in. That's selfish. That automatically bars his butt from getting in there. But, oh, it was such a great Christian show. It's like, oh, it's so blessed.
Well, it was a great show. But maybe, you know.
Yeah.
It was entertaining. I liked it. But
no,
you're not wrong, in other words. You're not wrong.
Yeah, you're among friends here. Don't worry about that. Okay, so anyway, now that I've completely sidetracked a discussion about the art of storytelling with a rant about religion.
Hey, that's what we do here. You never know what tangents we go on this show. That's one of the glorious things about our show. It is unpredictable. It is not a formula templated type show. We will talk about everything here. And welcome it. Yeah, we have. Yeah. I love the fact that we have a very, very open-minded audience that I've come to know. And yeah, we have all types on here. So, yeah,
yeah,
I love it.
You'll have a
I'm checking your books out.
Like,
I will.
I love
the sound of your book.
Yeah, give them a spin and see what you think of them. The second book, you see basically a plot involving Joan of Arc. There's something funny going on.
I saw that.
Unravel the mystery behind that. Yeah, it's a lot of different stuff in there. And Hope Springs Eternal has probably the hardest story that I wrote. Hope Springs Eternal features basically a narcissistic mother who has manipulated her daughter into having an incestuous affair with her. And because her daughter is innocent, her daughter can't be sentenced to hell. So she basically gets their fates tied together at court so that you can't punish the mother without punishing the daughter as well. They don't want to punish the daughter because – so it's like, okay, how does Hannah straighten this mess out? And it was a very hard story to write, especially because when the trauma of what the mother did to the daughter comes into play, there are moments in there that are absolutely heartbreaking. But that's how the story had to go. And once again, I created a character that was that good. I had to come up with something that difficult to get going. But then there's also stories that are completely goofy. Like in the first book, there's a story called Cunning Stunts about a daredevil who dies in an accident. And basically, the story is just an excuse for you to rattle off a bunch of cheap death jokes. He dies in the middle of a stunt at a show. And when Hannah gets back to heaven, say, Michael, so how was the show? She says, it was killer. Like I said, that one, there's no deeper meaning. There's no big philosophy. It's just, here's a bunch of death jokes. I couldn't fit them in another story. Throw them all in here.
That's amazing.
That's awesome. Well, we have another Peter question from the chat room, and actually it is something that kind of goes with what I saw when I checked out your YouTube page, because tangential to the religious discussion, do you watch anime? And if you do, his highest recommendation is Haibane Renmei, I guess Haibane Renmei. He's a very Christian. So, but yeah, he wanted to know about your whether you like into anime or not.
Yes, I do. I do enjoy anime, but I'm a little. I wouldn't say that I'm selective. It's. I tend to balk when things start becoming cliche. For a while there, like in the '90s when everything was becoming a super team. I'm a Sailor Moon fan, as I'm sure you noticed from my YouTube page. But then all of a sudden, everybody's coming out with I can take weapons great suits. But there's only so much Pretty Cure that I can take before I say, can you give me something else? And, you know, it seems like every 10 years or every decade, there's a new set of anime that everybody has to copy. You know, like before it was Sailor Moon, Pokemon, and Dragon Ball Z. We recently went through Attack on Titan, Sword Art Online, and Boruto. One piece. I don't count Inuyasha because Inuyasha pretty much has followed its own lead, and I'm thankful for that. I loved Inuyasha. For a lot of anime, when they go for like Spirited Away is still one of my favorite movies of all time, and that and Princess Mononoke are just deep in Japanese mythology and their philosophy regarding it all. So anime doesn't have to have a Christian bend in order for me to enjoy it. As far as like what my favorite anime is, it depends on when you catch me. I enjoy Sailor Moon, but I wouldn't call it my favorite because it does have its flaws. It does have some things that need some fix. My gateway anime, the first one I watched was Star Blazers, which was the American dub of Battleship Yomi.
Oh yeah,
yes, I love that show.
Specifically Star Blazers, because there was a dub of it earlier, but it sanitized things. Star Blazers actually addressed the fundamentals of the story, like how Captain Avatar was dying. So he went on this mission knowing he was never going to see home again. And it was a much more honest look. I love the Macross saga. My current favorites are, I think Assassination Classroom is a work of genius. I absolutely love Assassination Classroom. I think Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood is the superior of the two, but the first one is good also. If you have family, especially if you have a close relationship with your brother, that series is a punch in the gut, but it's beautiful. And if you want comedy, my current king of the heap is TQ. I love TQ. It is just a stitch to watch.
Very cool. Yeah, it's putting some good memories back in me from the stuff that I've enjoyed myself in anime. And
yeah, Yeah, like I said, I am a Sailor Moon fan, but it's mostly the first two seasons. With the third season, when Takeuchi started having struggles keeping up with her deadlines, and they had to make, because there's stuff in the show because they had to wait for her to finish the manga in order to make the episodes. Well, sometimes they had to take a leap of faith, and it turns out, well, that wasn't what she had in mind, and they had to backpedal. Mm-hmm. So, and that's also mm-hmm. part of the reason why I look at Crystal. It's like, you know, wow, the animation on the original wasn't that great to begin with. They actually went lower. Yikes. I'm not as big a fan of Crystal as I am of Classic, so, but that's just my taste. So, but yeah, and like I said, there's stuff like Inuyasha. I absolutely loved Inuyasha. Inuyasha I thought was a fantastic series. That one I couldn't wait to keep watching. So, but then I see so many. Before it was harem anime. I got so tired of that. Now it's isekai anime. It's like, can we move on? Can we come up with something different? But like I said, it's every 10 years. In 10 years, someone will come up with something that's new and fresh and different, and it'll be exciting. And then everybody will copy that, and my interest will go dormant for about 5 years, and then somebody will come up with something new. So I tend to view it very cyclically as far as what I enjoy and what I watch.
Very nice. Yep. Just laughing because yeah, I got some interesting banter back, Clayton. That's making me chuckle in the chat room there. He's a character. Oh my God, Clayton's one of a kind. But yeah, thank you for the questions, Clayton. Yeah, those are some good ones for sure. But we are coming up on about 4 minutes left, and definitely want to give you the chance to tell us how to find you online, especially ways for folks to contact you. I know that Clayton wants to reach out to you, mentioned that himself. And so definitely tell us all the ways that we can find the World of Peter G online.
Okay. Well, the two big ones, I have an Instagram account. It's once again, Signed to More Animation Studios. Signed to More, it's Latin. It means without fear, without insecurity. SINE space TIMORE space Animation Studios. That's where I've been rerunning my comic strips, and I keep things up to date. I also have a YouTube channel, Signed to More Animation Studios, and you go there, you can see things like, you can see One True Pairing, which was basically me taking fanfic pairings and putting them on a date, but I keep them in character and watch the whole thing go to hell. And the biggest one was one where I had Asuka and Rei from Evangelion go on a date, and oh, that was a fun one to make. There's Peter G. Sailor Moon Fanboy. I have a couple of preview clips of the Sailor Poland movie that I'm working on. Sailor Moon is a cosmic fantasy with romance overtones. Sailor Poland is a geopolitical allegory. The idea of it is that they all represent the spirit of their country's people. And one day everyone wakes up and Sailor America has been replaced by Donald Trump. So Sailor Poland is leading a quest to find the real Sailor America and bring her back before this idiot ruins everything. And you'll see a couple of previews for that on there. And just just all kinds of different little things on there. So, but yeah, you'll find a lot of it on YouTube. And and also Herman Crab, which is an all-ages ecological series about protecting the ocean, which that's gotten a lot of positive attention. I think you'll really enjoy that. That one is completely all-ages. Anybody can watch that. That's good. Sailor Poland, that one, basically anyone who knows me for my all-ages stuff is going to watch Sailor Poland. It's like, wow, those are some dirty jokes. Yeah. So, once again, it's a question of what's appropriate for what. But
very
those
cool.
are the two main ways to follow what I'm doing. And the Sailor Poland movie is kind of in turnaround because with Trump trying to basically stage a coup, I have to wait and see what happens so I know how to end the story. But I'm working on it still. It'll come. It's just I was originally going to have it out by Election Day, but with all this stuff going on, it's like, no, because it's going to change the entire interpretation of the nature. You know, the whole thing was what does it mean to be an American and a patriot in the modern age? Well, we're seeing it change before our very eyes right now. So I have to wait and see how this is going to end before I finish my project.
All right.
That's
all right.
Brave.
And
that's extremely brave.
That is.
It's nerve-wracking,
yeah.
too.
I like it.
I hit F5 on the computer and just dread. It's like, what's the lawsuit going? Please tell me this one won't work. I will not rest until Biden is sworn in on the 21st. Then I'll breathe easy. And I didn't even like Biden. I voted for the guy, but I didn't like him. But it's like, no, I got to get this idiot out of the White House. He's a disaster. Not only do I hate Trump, but he also made me support a candidate I didn't like. Thanks, buddy. Please, let's get rid of him.
Oh, 2020 has definitely been a year that I don't think has made anyone happy for any reason whatsoever.
It's a chess move, not a Tinder match.
I dreaded daylight savings time because it's like, do we really need an extra hour of this year? Seriously?
No,
well,
we are
about to run out of time, so I am going to have to go ahead and do my goodbye to everybody, and then Peter, go ahead and give your last comments, and then RG and Daniel take us out. This is Steven Zimmer, and thank you for joining us tonight on the Star Chamber Show live podcast. See you next week, 9 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday evening, and over to you, Peter.
Time will tell. It always does. That's a quote from the Seventh Doctor on Doctor Who. It's one of my favorites. So whatever happens, just keep watching because you never know how it's going to go.
A bunch of timey-wimey. Anyway, you can find me at rgwesterman.com. As always, it's good to hang out with everyone. Peter, it's nice to meet you and hope to see you at the next convention.
Great meeting you, too. Hope to see you there.
And this is
Daniel
Dart. If you enjoy learning about all phases of creativity and don't mind the banter that we have here, where we let anybody bring whatever they want to on the stage, join us again next week for another issue of the Star Chamber. This is Daniel Dark signing out.